From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Leg Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we learn about how the Milwaukee Turners organization is trying to reclaim its role as a progressive force in the city. Then, a Milwaukee boutique owner describes the losses and successes of operating a business during the pandemic.
The thing that has hit the hardest is probably us not being able to get together. It's not financial or anything like that for me or for Jazzy Ray. It's the connection piece.
A pianist takes on a daunting musical challenge inspired by his journey of overcoming physical and societal challenges.
I decided that this event, this concert, is a good reminder for myself. Not only that you will prevail, not only that this shall pass, but it is for the good.
Plus, we'll learn the do's and don'ts of giving to a local charity. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. If you know about the Milwaukee Turners, you probably know them for their music venue, Turner Hall, their rock climbing gym, or even their fish fry. But you might not know about the Turners' deep roots in Milwaukee, which date back to 1853. From their location in the heart of downtown, the Turners have been dedicated to strengthening the community through the idea of a sound mind and a sound body. Back in the 1800s, that looked like German men lifting weights, doing gymnastics, and discussing the issues of the day. But today's Turners look a little different, and their new executive director is embracing a new vision for the organization. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with the new director, Emilio De Torre, about how he's planning on drawing on the Turners' history to reclaim their role in Milwaukee. He starts with a short history lesson on the origins of the Turners.
The Turners came here from Germany. They were the 48ers, a generation of progressive and liberal German folks who had wanted change and democratic reform in Germany. And that failed. It was a failed conflict in Germany. And so they emigrated to the United States. And in 1853, you move forward a few years, the Turners started here in Milwaukee. It's funny, they started even before then as an offshoot of the Napoleonic Wars. And so this gentleman who they call Father Jan is considered the father of modern-day gymnastics, credited with inventing the rings and the uneven bars. And he felt upset that the Germans got squashed so easily, and so he wanted them to be stronger of spirit, mind, and body. And so they did all these exercise programs, and they were, and they had very progressive ideals. They were abolitionists. They felt strongly opposed to the notion that a human could own another human. Turners were very active in the Civil War. We have monuments to their battling there. They provided the bodyguard to Abraham Lincoln for his inauguration as well as his funeral. He didn't use them as bodyguards during theater night, so that's his mistake. And while they did this, they provided an opportunity for these immigrants to get together and socialize, you know, have fish fries, drink. They had forums. They talked about the issues of the day. You know, they asked for a mission statement lots of times when you're applying for a grant. And there really isn't a mission statement for the Turners. They have a sound mind and a sound body. And then they look at that through their four principles of liberty against all oppression, tolerance against all fanaticism, reason against all superstition, and justice against all exploitation. It's a mouthful. But it's something to be proud of. And so they've applied those philosophical elements to this notion of being fit and discussing these ideas. And so from the earliest days in the 1800s on, they pushed for immigration rights. They looked at women's suffrage. They wanted clear and transparent government. All three socialist mayors of Milwaukee, as well as some Democratic ones, were Turners. You know, the sewer socialists pushing for elimination of corruption. That's kind of their early history, and eventually they expanded and they moved here to the Turner Hall that you all love and know, which in addition to having having had fish fries and this rock and concert hall, has arguably one of the oldest continuously running gyms, if not the oldest continuously running gym in the United States, second oldest climbing wall in the United States, and it's run by Kim Kosmaitis, who's a Milwaukee legend here. And the rock climbing walls are great, and we just revamped our weights and gymnastics room, and I invite people to check it out. But that's where we were historically. They got a little quiet, I think, following Frank Zeidler, and focused a little more on on Fish Fries and having some of the discussions, say, with confronting mass incarceration, the forums, of course, when they took place on PBS as the 4th Street Forum, which was how I learned about Milwaukee when I moved here.
Yeah. So rich history in the 1800s, and then kind of a little bit of a fade or a low profile for the Turners. Where do you come into that? You recently started as executive director with the organization. What are you looking to draw from that past, and how are you looking to bring that into the future of the Turners?
This is the dream come true for me, Ben. So I spent many years working with the ACLU here in Wisconsin, traveling around different communities and growing to fall in love with my new home of Milwaukee. And I had been a card-carrying Turner prior to then, but outside of emceeing a few events and participating in events, I hadn't considered myself in this role. When I saw it was open, I leapt on it because this is a fantastic opportunity to have this beautiful building here in the heart of Milwaukee live up to its charge of supporting liberty, tolerance, reason, and justice. And I know, being somebody that's worked alongside so many different communities in Milwaukee, that they have resources here, and there's this like desire to do things for one another that people feel. There's this there's a desire to support one another and to break bread with one another and to acknowledge and recognize the differences we all have, but appreciate those and do things. And I saw this as an opportunity to kind of, you know, to build a Milwaukee Order of the Phoenix among good people. And we've been doing just that. We have more members now in the 7 months since I've been here. We're up to almost 400 members. We haven't had this many members since the 1800s.
Wow.
And this is great. And it's diverse membership. We have Black and Latinx and Asian and Native members. We have a lot of young members, your 25-year-old bracket. And they get invited to come to all of these different fora. We've been doing a lot more mutual aid, and we've been doing a lot more listening. So we've been partnering with folks like Ayuda Mutua, the Brown Berets, Metcalf Park Community Bridges, the different mutual aid groups that are part of the DSA. We're planning another mutual aid event where we gave out over 300 boxes of food with our community partners and $2,500 worth of gift certificates, food certificates to El Rey. And now we're bringing in the Humane Association so that they can also give free food to folks that are struggling to find employment. It doesn't mean that they should give up their furry family. So we'll kind of fit that in too.
Yeah. Is there anything from looking back at the Turner's history that you want to leave behind, whether that's, you know, more ancient 1800s history or, you know, more recent changes in the organization? Is there anything that you thought we can do this better or we can do this differently?
Yes. I ask that question of myself almost daily. And there are different things. So I'm still learning the history of the Turners right now, right? There's one of the things that I wanted to do better is I wanted to organize their history. And I'm working with these tremendous volunteers that are now archiving who their members are and preserving their history, because I think it was neglected. There's stuff forgotten in boxes with styrofoam plates, you know. What I don't want to do is I don't want to have the Turners become a museum. I think that the strong ideals that created the Turners and the way that they were able to serve Milwaukee and the different communities in Milwaukee based on their principles and ideals is what we need to re-embrace now. And I think that's what we're doing. And it's not just for this insular group, which was originally based on ethnic Germans and then German Americans, and they began to dig deeper into becoming a more Pan-American identity around World War II because they were so active in fighting the Nazis. And this is another part of the history people don't talk about. They were the first group in the state to ban Nazis from being members and to beg the State Department to take sanctions against Germany even before Kristallnacht. I mean, I didn't know this until I was here. So I want us to be active in that way again, and I want the Turners to reflect the myriad faces and interests of the different people. We've reinvigorated the newsletter, and we have all of these fantastic people contributing articles and artwork and stories to the newsletter, not just one person. I have a fantastic and diverse and growing board. We are now creating an RFP so that we can have somebody new in the restaurant and see what that looks like by plugging into who we are as a reinvigorated Turner identity, and then partnering with our friends, the Pabst, who rent out the ballroom and put on these great concerts. And it would be nice to have a restaurant that integrates with all of this and can be vibrant. Some of the things I want to leave behind too, I mean, we've been finding hilarious things we're trying to share on Instagram, like this very lengthy letter written by a man in 1897 who felt he was falsely accused of having thrown up in the bar across the bar tabletop. And he writes this, you know, flowery Victorian 1,000-word essay about how it wasn't him and he feels his honor has been besmirched, and he's practically challenging this man that was laughing at him to fisticuffs or a duel. I don't want that kind of nonsense, but I do want to elevate those stories.
I will be thinking about that person next time I'm in Turner Hall.
We're always finding new things in here, too. We had a group of paranormal investigators led by my friend Susan Scott Fry spend 48 hours in here so we could take a look at doing a haunted Turner Hall. I don't know if you can see over my shoulder. I have my three ubiquitous office comrades here. There's three urns that have the ashes of previous Turners, two of which were found in walls in the building.
Oh, wow. That is spooky.
Yeah. Can you imagine? You're doing a little construction. You think, uh-oh, this isn't from Penzies.
Looks a little like white pepper, I imagine. You know, every time I've been in Turner Hall, I'm marveling at like the building itself. It has a very National Treasure feel to it, you know, and hearing about the urns in the walls adds to that. How do you want to use that building and your location there downtown to kind of branch out and reach more of Milwaukee? Right now, maybe it looks a little different during the pandemic, but as we get out of this phase and things start to open up again, what does that look like for you?
That's a very big part of what our vision is right now. And we wanted to provide service and support. We want to be a vital organ in the body that is Milwaukee. And so one of the programs that we experimented with was called Level Up from Stress. And we'd heard from a lot of our friends who are doing incredible work in especially Black and Latino communities in Milwaukee, that working all day and then providing food and resources to people suffering from COVID and subsequent unemployment has been difficult for them. Folks have been smoking more, you know, drinking, eating unhealthy, stressing out. And so we created a program with a bunch of partners to provide mental fitness, physical fitness, nutrition, and let our gym be a service and let our space be a service, including like responsibly distanced recreation. So we offered all of these things for free to these folks that probably had never considered what Turner Hall was or been here. And we gave them wellness packages so they could take these things home. It's not charity, it's solidarity, it's mutual aid. Like, you're doing these things for Milwaukee, let this small piece of Milwaukee do for you. And now we're working with other partners to tell this story and hopefully scale it up. We'd like to work with the families of people who have loved ones that are incarcerated, so that now why people are facing a reality in a pandemic of being the single provider for their family, the breadwinner, the parent, the nurturer, where can they come together and speak to folks that are in a similar situation? How can they talk about issues of dignity? Is there a way we can get some mental health specialists to work with them? We have all of the space and rooms. Let's put it to a good use. And let's also make them card-carrying Turners so that they can take advantage of our gym and our resources and our panel discussions.
Yeah.
That's how I see it growing. You know, people should avail themselves of this and know that the whole city is their city. We need to move past the segregation that has given us this horrible racist identity in Milwaukee. You know, it's one of the most segregated cities in the country, and take advantage of the things that are here for them.
Emilio De Torre is the executive director of the Milwaukee Turners. He spoke with Lake Effect's Ben Benversi. WUWM is featuring voices from local minority-owned businesses as a part of our series called COVID Earners. 1 year into the pandemic, this series is highlighting the struggles businesses have faced and how they've persevered. Today, we hear from John Ray Stowers. She runs a clothing boutique called Jazzy Ray Jewels and Accessories on Vliet Street in Milwaukee. Stowers Boutique is more than just a place to shop for fashionable outfits and jewelry. She says it's a place where women lift each other up and network. Stowers spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about how she's managed to keep the sense of community going as a part of our COVID Earner series. She begins by describing the boutique.
I would say the customers like to call it the home of statement making apparel and accessories. We are very much about sisterhood and about coming together to celebrate women. The space is a place where women commune. We've been known to be called the women's sanctuary, where women can come and shop, and being in the store is all about them. So they can, you know, sit down for a minute, talk, network, connect, have fun, laugh. It's just a great place to be.
It sounds like it's a lot more than just a clothing store.
It is. It is. It really is a networking place. Like, when women come in, they're shocked when they see, you know, someone they haven't seen in years. So it's like, oh my goodness, we hear that a lot. And so we're very much a, it's like, I call it a sisterhood. Like, we high five each other. We let people cry in there, and we have tissue ready. You know, it's just a place where women can just have a moment and shop, right? Because shopping is the most important component.
And treating themselves, it's kind of like a self-care kind of thing. Like, finding something that looks good on you is kind of an emotional pickup as well as just looking nice.
It is. And when women come out of the fitting room, you know, we're like, hey, you know, go ahead and walk the runway. You look good, you know, and, you know, it really pumps the woman up. So that is that in itself is so much fun just to watch and see.
So there's no necessarily specific target customer. It's kind of like, or is there one?
That's a great question. There isn't. You know, when I first started the brand, it was all about plus size women, right? Because I was focused on the clothes and trying to find nice clothes for plus size women. Actually, it was jewelry, and then it morphed to plus size women. But then it just took off on its own, and now it became this boutique. I would say it's for the more of the professional woman, if you will, who I consider the clothes conservative sexy. So, like, it's conservative enough where, you know, you can wear it to the office. But when you leave the office, if you want to show a little bit of shoulder, you can. But it's not necessarily, you know, but it's conservative, you know. I'm a married woman of almost 19 years. I have to keep it classy. Yeah.
the stuff that I've seen on the website, it looks very chic and it looks comfortable. It looks like the kind of stuff that you could wear going out, you could wear to work. And then the statement pieces, there's a lot of chunky jewelry, things that make a bold impression, right?
Very much so. Yeah, I would say probably within the last year, we've gotten a little more comfortable. But right.
But maybe some stuff before the pandemic would be a little more cinched in or something.
Yeah, a little more, you know, statement making for events, right? You know, where you can dress up a little more, toss on a heel or two, you know. But definitely now with the pandemic, things have shifted a little bit.
So that leads into the next sort of question. What was business like before the pandemic? You talked about the Divas Brunch, and you talked about, I just want to know what some of your successes were and what some of your challenges were before the pandemic.
Okay, so the successes before the pandemic, like I said, the space was an open space for women to come and just hang out. It was a hangout. You know, women would plan their Saturdays around coming to the shop, right? We call it the shop. And so, you know, we would have cheese and crackers, cookies, you know, whatever we needed to just, we may order pizza that day in the shop. Because it was all about shopping and networking. And I would say that was definitely a success of ours and what set us apart from other boutiques. And then after the pandemic, or during the pandemic, you know, we had to close our doors. And I would say the first 3 months of the pandemic, I struggled. It was hard for me. One, it's because I'm an extreme extrovert. I love people. I can talk to anybody, you know, and I love seeing women come together and connect or exchange business cards. Or I would say my strength is definitely connecting. I'm a connector. So I struggled because I had to close my doors. So with closing the doors, I had to think of what can I do to get these women you know, on board and connecting with us and remembering us. And so how can I still, you know, keep the brand going? And so it turned into the whole comfort piece of clothing, right? So we're all working from home. We all still want to be kind of cute. And we all, you know, and we need to be comfortable, right? And so I came up with the Diva Set. So the Diva Set is a nice top with the matching bottoms. Usually it's like a legging set, if you will, stretchy material so that if you're sitting down for a long time, you don't feel anything cutting into you. You know, it's very comfortable. But not only did I want it to be comfortable, I wanted it to be cute. And so that became what helped, I definitely think, keep the doors open during the pandemic. So, you know, I'm offering different color sets, different kind of sets, set after set after set. And so that was one thing. And I think that when we were able to do curbside, I remember the first time we did curbside and one of my customers pulled up to get her order and she just cried in the car. And when I tell you, it gets me emotional now, so I'm not going to do any crying on it. But when she cried in the car, you know, it was her first like contact with adults other than her husband and children. You know, it was like, wow. And the fact that they missed being at the shop, and when women start to realize that the shop is their place, right? That's, it's almost like, you know, when you go to Target, you like at Target, but you're shopping. You're not necessarily meeting with people, you're shopping. But you know, at the boutique, you're shopping, you're meeting with people, you're being loved on, you're sharing information. So it definitely was a pivot that we had to do, and we're still doing, because I'm not officially open yet. I'm still doing curbside. I have a Facebook group. It's a private group where, you know, we're in there. We could be changing clothes in there so you can see what an outfit looks like. We're putting encouraging messages. We're asking questions, you know, what's happening in your world? How are you feeling about this? You know, the hot topics. So it has went from where women were in the store to now we have this online platform in this private group to still express ourselves. And then from that group, we implemented two additional initiatives. One is called the Divas Connect Initiative, and that is where women get paired up with other women, and throughout the month, they're expected to get together, whether it's for coffee, whether it's for a Zoom or something like that. And then we also have a book club where we're reading a book each month, and we're getting together to talk about it at the end of the month. So just to kind of keep the community going within Jazzy Ray.
That's amazing. You're really taking it upon yourself to like find the humanity and the connection once physical distancing started. You were just like, I need to make sure that this business keeps the community together.
Exactly. I always say, Jazzy Ray, where fashion and community connects. Mm-hmm.
Given this past year, essentially, because it's been since March of 2020 that we've all been going through this, what has hit the hardest on the bottom line, and how have you been able to basically stay afloat?
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that has hit the hardest is probably us not being able to get together. That hit the hardest. It's not financial or anything like that for me or for Jazzy Ray in particular. It's the connection piece. And so I think that that's why the Jazzy Ray group is so important. And I would say what has helped us stay afloat was just being creative with the offerings. And I've learned a lot about the business. Like now I have a VIP tech club and things like that. Financially, I'm one of those people who did not take advantage of all of the offerings for small businesses. I'm just now starting to look at it. I just wasn't in that headspace at the time. I was more concerned about the people, and I was more concerned about the people and not the money aspect of things, because I was making it. And so I think that I was allowing those who were struggling to kind of hop on their needs in terms of support, governmental support or whatever that is. Thankfully and prayerfully, I didn't necessarily need that.
And that's because economically it's not your number one source of income.
Absolutely. Correct.
you have the ability to kind of try to keep it flourishing, but not have like money and finances be the leading driver of it.
Exactly. And that's what makes it so beautiful, because I get to just do what I love. And thank you for referencing that, because I feel like I'm blessed in that I get to have the best of both worlds, if you will. So by day, I'm an educator, right? Because I love my students. I love teaching. I love encouraging, mentoring, all of that. And then on the weekends and at night, I love women and fashion and all those things. And so I get to do them both, and I love them both.
Jeremy Stowers, thank you so much. Keep making people in Milwaukee look cute. And thank you for speaking to us about your business.
Thank you so much for having me.
John Ray Stowers is the owner of Jazzy Ray Jewels and Accessories in Milwaukee. She spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver as a part of our COVID Earners series. To hear more stories of how Milwaukee businesses have adjusted during the pandemic, go to WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll learn the do's and don'ts of giving to a local charity as many of us begin spring cleaning. But first, pianist Wael Farouk shares his journey of overcoming physical and societal challenges, which has led him to attempt a piano marathon.
I am dedicating this concert for overcoming and combating three social injustices, so oppression, persecution, and discrimination, which I found fitting.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In the world of piano, there are few pieces that command as much respect and fear as Rachmaninoff's Third Concerto. But that's not stopping Wael Farouk. He's planning a concert where he will take on Rachmaninoff's first three concertos, back to back to back. Farouk is embracing the challenge, as he has done throughout his life. Farouk was born with shorter ligaments in his hands, and he's unable to make a fist. In addition to his physical challenges, Farouk has faced social challenges, first as a Coptic Christian in Cairo, Egypt, and then as an immigrant to the United States. Fittingly, he chose as the title of the concert, Climbing Beyond Everest, Three Musical Mountains and Three Systemic Injustices, Discrimination, Oppression, and Persecution. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with Farouk from his office at Carthage College to learn about Farouk's story ahead of the historic feat.
My journey with Rachmaninoff started really when I was about 12 and a half years old. I was a young student at the Cairo Conservatory, where I have been at that time studying for 4 years. But prior to my studies at the conservatory, I was told by several experts, shall we say, and professional pianists, that I should never consider a career in piano because my hand condition, I was born with very special hands, short ligaments. I cannot make a fist even till today. And my fourth and fifth fingers on both hands are curved quite a lot, so it limits my stretch even further. So even though I placed one of the highest grades at the entrance exams at the Cairo Conservatory, all the professors really discouraged me and officially told me and my dad that, you know, this career is not for him. And my dad, who knew nothing about music but knew a lot about hard work and good work ethics, said, well, if you say he's talented, why don't you give him a chance? So they really tried to make it difficult for me in the first 3 months. They tried to give me the homework of 2 years to accomplish in those 3 months to really make their point. But luckily, I was stubborn and persevered, and I stayed 14 years at that institution. But 4 years later, I was very fortunate to be placed in the studio of one of the best teachers really in the world, who was at that time teaching in Egypt, who happened to be Russian. And he said, you know, this is how difficult some of the piano repertoire are. Take a listen to that piece. And he gave me a recording of Rachmaninoff III Piano Concerto. And the Rachmaninoff III Piano Concerto is really nicknamed by all professional pianists as Mount Everest of the piano. Whether you are a Rachmaninoff advocate or Rachmaninoff aficionado, or you don't care for Rachmaninoff, nobody really disputes this fact that this is definitely one of, or the peak of the piano literature,
uh-huh,
in terms of its difficulty and complexity. So I heard the piece for the first time when I was 12. It was about 45 minutes long. And from the first second till the very last second, I was just frozen. I was under this spell. It's not even music anymore. It's just an experience, a life experience. And I was possessed, really. And the next day I went, I didn't even feel myself walking, you know, to the room of my teacher, my study. I just felt like I was, you know, floating. And they said, you know, I did hear the piece. I see what you mean, but I really have to play this. My teacher at the time, his name was Demidov. He was about 6'4", large hands, and he said, well, oh, forget it, you know, I've been working on this for 40 years myself, you know, this is going to destroy you, it's going to damage you both psychologically, physically, forget it. So anyway, being old, stubborn me, I worked, you know, 14, 15 hours a day, couple of years following that, and about 4.5 years later, I was the first Egyptian to ever play that piece in Cairo. So that was not only a milestone in my life, but really because of that piece, I became a pianist and I am where I am today. So every time I am asked to play the third, it brings back all of those great memories. But this time, we're not only doing number three, but doing numbers one, two, and then three at the same evening. So numbers one and two are not, you know, peanuts of the repertoire. They are still quite the big mountains, but having all three together makes this very, very special.
Yeah. So playing these three concertis back to back to back has never been done before. And for people who don't understand the difficulty of this feat, can you attempt to explain it?
I will attempt. Let's talk about the difficulties of doing back to back to back. This is like running three marathons. We're only taking 10 minutes between each piece and saving the hardest one all the way to the end, because we're playing them in order. So we're playing numbers one and then two and then three, which is, you know, almost more difficult than one and two combined and then some. So the physical challenges were already apparent. I don't think I need to speak much into that, but also the mental challenges and the focus and the emotional challenges, that's yet another sphere. So they take about close to 2.5 hours, but I'm playing all of those pieces from memory.
Yeah.
So I'm not using a score, and there are a lot of cues between you and the conductor and the orchestra, and of course, because of the pandemic, we're have to record this event in an empty hall, so it's not open to the public, so the sound is quite different. And an orchestra of 60 or 70 players usually are sitting in a cozy setup together for sound purposes and for lineup and for cues and eye contact purposes. But now, because of the pandemic, everybody has to have 6 feet in between. So the orchestra will be spread over 2.5 states, right? So some will be in Illinois and some will be, you know, God knows where. And so that will be an extra challenge. So they are viewed as three musical mountains, and I am dedicating this concert for overcoming and combating three social injustices, so oppression, persecution, and discrimination, which I found fitting. You know, Rachmaninoff himself went through a lot of persecution as labeled as third-rate composer, which he was really not at all. He suffered defeat, he suffered depression, but he still picked up his pieces and gathered himself and really established himself as one of the most important figures musically in the 20th century.
It strikes me in hearing your story and the challenges that you've overcome physically, societally, that you are who you are, not in spite of those challenges, but precisely because of them. You incorporate those difficulties and challenges into your story, and it's part of who you are.
You know, growing up, not only having these physical challenges in my hands and also in my eyes, I was born with very, very rare eye condition, that both my inner lenses are not in the right place. So that caused me to have really poor eyesight, which in a way prevented me from playing a lot outside with other kids, but at the same time compelled me and given me a lot of satisfaction sitting at my piano, sight reading a lot of music and memorizing massive amount of music, which, you know, I'm playing today. But also, you know, I grew up in Egypt as a Coptic Christian, and at that time, things were not very easy for Christians, and there was a lot of persecution. Mm. 5 years ago, the scene completely changed with the current president, and there is a lot of equality that took place. But back then, in the 80s and 90s, it was expected, if you are a Christian, that you just to be thrown in jail for your faith. And, you know, I had family members who went through that. And, of course, my own parents growing up in 40s and 50s and 60s, things were even harder for them because of their faith. So that, in a way, gave me the concept of resilience and really being proud of what you have, and these, and your faith is really what gotten you through many of these difficulties. However, over the past 5 years and seeing the times we are in today with what's happening in the world, you know, the events of last week in Boulder or Atlanta or Kenosha, a couple miles from where I live, the events of the last summer, and connected those with some of my experiences the last 4 or 5 years facing similar, you know, difficulties and I would say discrimination and even persecution having to do with where I am from or what I believe in or what kind of faith you have. I decided that this event, this concert, is a good reminder for myself and a good reminder for those who are facing such times. Not only that you will prevail, not only that this shall pass, but it is for the good, and it's something will shape you and will make you stronger, and it will, you know, we have this verse in the Bible that gold is tested by fire, and I believe the more you have, the more you will go through, and obstacles and sufferings are not to label you who you are. They really provoke success and strength out of you.
Mm. I heard that your father gave you a toy piano for your third birthday as a kind of as a way to potentially help you, you know, stretch out your ligaments and give you some increased dexterity in your hands. But it's just, it's fascinating to follow that little 3-year-old YL to where we are now and how you've channeled all of that experience and managed to now share it with others.
The toy piano story always, you know, makes me smile, because when I was 2.5, that's when my parents noticed that my hands are really not functioning because they're too small. I couldn't hold on to anything. My dad took me to a physician at 2.5 and said, well, what should we do? Does he need operation, surgery, injections? And the good old doctor said, well, you know, he doesn't need any of that. You stay away from his hands. Let him be. Just let him exercise it in something natural. So my parents, who knew nothing about music, let alone classical music, which is not that common in Cairo, Egypt, my dad got me that toy piano for my third birthday, just in a way, as you exactly said, to use my hand to, and that became my best friend in the world. So yes, playing the piano is one of the hardest things you can do. Not, you know, not if you're playing it recreationally or therapeutically, right? But if you are playing it professionally and making it your life and your livelihood, it becomes challenging. But to be honest, I never felt for one second that playing the piano is a struggle for me. Absolutely the opposite. You know, the great pianist Franz Liszt said, piano is my mother tongue is the best language I speak. It is like a horse to an Arab, and it's like a boat to a sailor. That's what piano is for me. And it's never felt more comfortable and more healing and more like having a conversation with yourself and using it, as you said, to express yourself, using it to express what you believe in and to share what you feel with your students, with your peers, with your colleagues, with your audience. It's yet another gift that music brings us and what piano especially means to me.
Thank you for sharing your story well, and good luck with your performance. If you, I don't know that you'll need it, but good luck.
Well, we all need luck, but thank you for wishing it, and I appreciate our conversation.
Wael Farouk is an assistant professor of music and director of keyboard studies at Carthage College. His concert, Climbing Beyond Everest, will be available to stream online April 17th through June 15th. You can find more information about the concert at wuwm.com. With spring in full swing, many of us have begun spring cleaning, putting aside clothes and other items for donations. But giving unwanted or unusable items to charity can just cause them more stress.
An office will have a clothing drive, which is such a great idea, but it's really not, because then people look at that as a way just to get rid of everything they have in their house.
After the break, we'll learn about the do's and don'ts of giving to local charities. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's that time of year again, the season of spring cleaning. Many of us have already started to tidy up our homes, putting aside clothes, furniture, and a variety of things we no longer want. But there's always that lingering question, if I don't want it, does anyone else? Some charities have the space to keep and sort donations, but many local organizations don't, and they're often the charities most in need. So what should you do? Jerry Cavanaugh has some answers. Cavanaugh is the volunteer coordinator at Community Advocates, a local nonprofit that helps Milwaukeeans meet their basic needs. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain how you should and shouldn't give to local charities.
So it's springtime, which means a lot of us are starting to go through our homes doing a lot of spring cleaning. And it's also a time when a lot of people are looking to donate a lot of these things, you know, things that they think, oh, someone else can enjoy this. So when we're going through our homes looking for things that we can donate, what are some of the things that are useful?
So from my point of view, we have a shelter on the near south side, which is a temporary housing for men, women, and children. So we are always looking for, this does not have to be new, this can be gently used. So twin sheets, blankets, mattress covers. And then we're always looking for diapers, any size. And then socks are huge, not only for our shelter, but for the homeless. So we're looking for socks from infancy all the way up to adult, male and female. We're looking for new underwear, new bras. In the gently used area, you know, when school starts, we'll be looking for backpacks and school supplies. So when you just, you know, think of that type of thing. Also, when the individuals leave our shelter and they go to their own apartment, and then we're looking for things like a gently used sofa or a gently used mattress and box spring, you know, kitchen table and chairs, things of that nature. So for all of it, we're just looking for things that are gently used, you know, not something that's falling apart or has lots of stains on it. You know, we want the individuals that we're serving to feel, you know, as special as the other person when they receive something.
Yeah, of course. Now, when we're thinking about these kinds of gently used things, especially when we're talking about larger things like furniture or things that might not be in season, like backpacks, something that you're hoping to get, you know, more toward the fall, is that something you should donate to a charity right now, or should you hold on to it until people are asking for it?
Well, our problem is, and you know, I'm not speaking for all nonprofits, but I, I've heard from many is that we don't have a lot of storage. So I'm always putting out our current wish list so that it just is the things that we're looking for right now today, because we just don't have the room to keep everything. I always say to call first when you're getting ready to do a donation, just to make sure that number one, the organization is accepting donations, especially now during COVID. And number two, that you're donating something that they really need. So the worst thing is to come up with a carload of things and then have that organization say, we're not taking donations right now. And then you're feeling frustrated. And so it's just better to give a call ahead.
So if you're hoping to donate to a nonprofit like yours, should you look for that wish list? Is that something that a lot of nonprofits do?
Well, they either will put it on their website, or you can just call them and they'll shoot you an email. I mean, just this week alone, I probably had four or five different organizations that want to do a drive with their employer, and they're looking for what we need. And I'm always very grateful that they ask me first, because we just don't have the room to put things that we can't use.
I think there's always a question among people when they're going through things. Is this something that is worth donating? What are some of the items that you end up getting that you go, no one can use this? This is not something anyone's going to need.
Well, I have a whole list. So I also run the Bottomless Closet. It's an entity within Community Advocates that provides clothing to men and women looking for employment. So what happens with that is an office will have a clothing drive, which is such a great idea, but it's really not, because then people look at that as a way just to get rid of everything they have in their house. Where I will specifically say, I'm looking for business casual clothing, and I'll get a swimsuit, I'll get a pajamas, I'll get, you know, soiled bras. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, I just, you know, or, you know, if we're talking about furniture, you know, you'll get a mattress that has, you know, urine stains on it. That's not something that you would want anyone to sleep on. So I always say to yourself, would I want this? Is this something that I would want if it was donated to me? You know, if you can't answer that question yes, then you probably don't want to donate it either.
Business clothes seem to be a big one, especially as we're talking about people who might not be homed currently, people who are looking for jobs. Do you have tips on what you should and shouldn't donate if it's business clothing, if it's business casual? Is something that's really retro, you know, not what you want, or can it really be from any decade?
Well, everybody's different and everybody has their own unique style. So, you know, some women like that retro style. The problem is I don't have a room for a lot of it, but I have seen women especially go into the closet and find a really funky suit that they might want. So it's always best just to ask, you know, would you be interested in this at this time? But what I always say is, you know, like, really nice casual pants and tops is probably the biggest seller that we have, you know, that we give away here at the Bottomless Closet, because not a lot of individuals are wearing suits anymore. Unless you have a big high power job as a lawyer and you're going into court, you're not wearing a suit anymore. So you're really wearing a nice pair of pants and a nice top and maybe a blazer. And for a man, you're looking at just a nice pair of pants and a shirt, maybe a tie, but, you know, not always anymore. So
a gently used button up, a pencil skirt, things like that.
Yeah, a pencil skirt is awesome. And then when we're talking about shoes, you know, shoes that don't have a lot of scuff marks on them, you know, if they can be polished, I'll polish them. But, you know, just so that they're not, they've been worn so much that you're ready to give it away. That's why we don't get a lot of men's shoes, because men wear their shoes until they can't wear them anymore. Where women will have 15 pair of shoes in their closet. So a lot of times when they donate them, some of them look like new.
Yeah. As we're thinking about just being charitable in general, would you say donations are the right way to go? Clothing donations, furniture donations, or does an organization like yours prefer cash?
Well, that's a good question. The nice thing about cash is that we can do with it what our biggest need is. So like on our list right now, we need strollers, pack and plays, car seats. That is not something that we may get some, but we don't get a lot. So if we get a cash donation, that's something that we can go out and get those items and shop around to get, you know, something that's pretty good quality for a very good price. So cash is always welcome, and we really appreciate it.
Well, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say it's great to get clarity when we're thinking about donations and what's going to be the most useful for organizations. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me and sharing your work.
All right, thank you.
Jerry Cavanaugh is the volunteer coordinator for Community Advocates, a local nonprofit that helps Milwaukeeans meet their basic needs. Cavanaugh spoke with Like Effect's Joy Powers. And that's Like Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Ben Benversi and Joy Powers join me in producing Like Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Angelina Mosher Salazar, Latoya Dennis, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday to hear some of the latest Listen MKE on racial tensions between Black and Asian communities in Milwaukee. Plus, Bubbler Talk explores the historic churches on Milwaukee's South Side. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take us on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, just look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thanks so much for joining us today right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.